Unless you are Elon Musk or Steve Jobs, you better be humble.
So everyone goes in an interview saying, you know, I plan to work here for the next 10 years.
We started NASSCOM itself. We knew we were jumping into something big.
And life was a struggle.
The future of a conservation architect is in ruins.
An untold story. Fortunes of a billion people change.
Those forests come moments that are different.
People love to talk about themselves. You're quite right.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Uppercase podcast. Uppercase is a digital content company. Look us up for blogs, newsletters, social media and more. I'm your host Anjana and every week I get trailblazers to tell you about the habits, practices and beliefs that have contributed to their success and happiness.
My guest today is Avnish Bajaj. Avnish is the founder and managing director of Matrix Partners. Avnish has, of course, been an angel investor. He's been a tech entrepreneur himself. He's also a mentor to young entrepreneurs, such as myself, I like to believe. Well, not young, but new. But so, Avnish, you know, when you started Bazi, which was, in 2000?
Yeah.
So you said you got into entrepreneurship because it was a way to make money, obviously, but it was also a way to control your own destiny.
Yeah.
Right? Now, today, I think, you know, the market out there is so crowded. There was about 700 odd startups registered back in 2016. Today, there's about 66,000. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on. There's a lot of noise in the market as well and the economic turmoil. Would you say that this is a good time for entrepreneurs to try something new? Or do you think if you're in a stable job, hold on for a while?
So first of all, thank you for having me on this episode. I was looking through the questions you sent. I'm amazed and kudos on all the great research you have done. It could not be a better time to start. When I came back to India and started, I was a banker before that in New York, and I was looking at all these research reports. And I forgot to check whether there were any internet users in India. So 22 years later, there are about 700-800 million, right?
Yeah.
So if you look at the market, it is here. If you look at your own behavior, some of it would have changed during COVID. I saw that with my wife, who was not very tech savvy.
Mm-hmm.
Today, everything happens online.
Absolutely.
So a lot of pieces were falling into place. Demonetization was criticized a lot. It was great for digital India.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, all the payments went online. GST has been criticized a lot. In my view, it's not only been great for digital India because it created one market. It's been great for India. If you look at the tax revenues now and how much GST is collecting, some of these things take time. So a lot of the macro things have fallen into place. Digitization has happened. If I had to start a business now, even as a young entrepreneur, this is a better time to start than last year. And it seems counterintuitive. But when you start in frothy markets, anyone can start in frothy markets. Your conviction in the business and the idea does not get tested enough. Your conviction in yourself doesn't get tested enough. Your conviction in your ability to take that risk. If you're going to, I know we'll talk about resilience.
Yes.
If you're going to go through cycles, then your resilience gets tested in a down cycle. If you start in a down cycle, it won't get worse than that. Right.
Well,
so I think if you look at back in history, Google got started in 2002. Instagram got started in 2009. WhatsApp got started in 2009. These are all babies of recessions. These are all babies of down markets.
Mm-hmm.
WhatsApp got sold for 2 billion or something. No, 20 billion to Facebook. It had 25 employees. It was built so lean. When businesses start in downturns, they are built the right way. So to me, you know, not often in life do you get opportunities where the answer is so obvious? And it's like saying, this stock I know is worth 1,000 rupees, but unfortunately, it's always trading at 1,500 rupees. Today, that stock is trading at 200-300 rupees. There are very few times in life where you get such dislocations that you can take advantage of. We are entering that time in India. I think that time is going to last maybe a few quarters, maybe 2-3 years. But this is the first time where markets would have turned down in terms of valuation, sentiment, all of that, when fundamentals are actually strong. And that's a great time to actually start businesses.
So. Sure. But now, you know, you obviously have your founders first philosophy. You work very closely with your founders as well. And you've been investing in India in Indian companies for a long time. What would you say is a rookie mistake that, you know, almost everyone makes?
When operating people start off as investors, the rookie mistake they make is they back themselves, not the person they are supposed to be backing. So you end up backing your own thesis. I started a marketplace business, right, Bazi?
Right.
My first 3-4 investments after I became an investor, mm-hmm. I was investing in myself. I was investing in my thesis. And I was waiting to meet people who would agree with me and then invest in them because they agreed with me.
Right.
All those investments didn't work. When the penny dropped that actually you have to do exactly the opposite. And by the way, the founder of Matrix in the US, there's this gentleman called Paul Ferry. Mm-hmm. I had asked him this question. And he said, your problem is you will want to be the smartest person in the room. Whereas your job is to back the person who's the smartest person in the room. And that's the mistake people make. Because you have so much context, you think you have done it all.
So that's for an investor, right?
Yeah.
What about for an entrepreneur? You're working with so many entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
What is it that they do that you feel that will got, you know, time
a
and time again?
Solution looking for a problem. So they will say, this is a great idea. Why? One of the things I think we'll come to at some point is the difference between experienced entrepreneurs and first-time entrepreneurs. People who have experienced a problem.
Yeah.
And then they come up with first of all, you have to decide, can you solve that problem? Let's say you can solve that problem. Is your solution 10x different from an existing solution? So
sure.
If you look at, let's take Ola, Uber versus Black and Yellow. You are in Bombay. Black and Yellow was a highly broken experience.
Yes.
Right? But before the mobile phone and being able to look at where the cabs were, so many different taxi services were started.
Right.
Air conditioned, all of that. They didn't work because you couldn't solve it in a 10x different way. It was a broken experience.
Sure.
It's when you're location-based stuff came. So I think that's where the people make the mistake, which is it's a solution,
yes.
But where's the problem? Who and can you solve that problem in a 10x better? So one is solution looking for a problem. Second, not thinking about whether it is a 10x different experience or a 1x.
Just marginal, yeah.
If it is marginal, it won't last. Somebody else will come in, somebody will add it as a feature, or nobody will be willing to pay for it.
Sure. Now, so obviously, what's very important for you, for everybody really, is decision making, right? When you decide which companies to invest in,
yeah.
It's important. But like you said, for entrepreneurs as well, to understand whether the product that they're developing is good enough.
Yeah.
Right? So decision making is also something that you study, you read
yeah.
a lot.
Yeah.
So what would you say, firstly, are there any books that you would recommend?
So actually, decision making is not where my own journey... So let me ask you, how do you decide? Or which part of your body decides?
For me, I think, unfortunately, I have to admit, I'm very impulsive, which is very wrong.
Hopefully, by the end of this conversation, it's all that. But what part of your body decides?
That I would like to say brain. I know that's the correct answer. But
it is the correct answer, but the gut doesn't decide. Let me let people know. Gut doesn't have decision-making ability. So... ultimately, I'll tell you, the journey actually started with trying to figure out, and maybe you can call it a midlife crisis, 4, 5, 6 years ago, when you feel that everything is kind of going well. My problem generally in life is I try to trigger changes when things are going well. I don't wait for things to, turn. So it was about this pursuit of happiness.
So sorry, you mean you preempt...
Well, I like to think so.
Okay.
But it became a question of a pursuit of happiness.
Right.
And what really makes people happy? Because if everything is kind of going well and yet you are sometimes feeling not fulfilled, and that's how it all started. What it led to was thinking more and more around the brain and the chemistry of the brain. So this pursuit of happiness has led me down the spiritual path.
Right.
I have followed all the gurus, whether it's Sri Sri, whether it's Sadhguru, whether it's Vipassana, done the whole spirituality path with Indian spirituality. Buddhist spirituality, read about Western approaches to this, and then somehow meandered into a more neurochemistry and brain. And being a logical person, for me, that's where it kind of all came together. And now let me simplify it. The brain has three parts.
Okay.
You know, and I call it, believe it or not, even my children now know this. Are you thinking from the lower brain, your middle brain, or your higher brain? And it genuinely is organized like that. Lower brain is your emotion, the reaction, the impulse.
Mm-hmm.
The frontal brain is where you do the planning. And the neocortex, the back brain, is what I consider where judgment comes from. So to answer the question, best decisions come from neobrain, from your neocortex. Everything, if you bring it together, whether you will hear, do a gratitude prayer, do meditation, go to oxygen bars, do exercise, play sport, listen to music. All of these Eastern, Western tools are to unlock your higher brain. That's it. Whichever tool works for you. I have developed some of these tools that work for me. Best decisions come from them. Now, the books that will put this in some framework or the other, there is Thinking Fast and Slow from Dan Kahneman, right? Mm-hmm. Thinking Fast is your impulse, the lower brain. Slow is slow it down, let the neocortex take over. Some people will call it higher consciousness. Mahatma Gandhi said, actually, believe it or not, when I don't have an answer, I sleep over it. Next morning, because your higher consciousness is kicking in. So yeah, all of these you can, you know.
I do practice that, I have to say. So, I do try to practice that, but yeah. Often I feel.
Yeah. So let me just finish the books that might help people.
Yeah.
Think Again, there's a book, Super Forecasting, Art of Thinking Clearly, but more on the neurochemistry, mind hacking, positivity, and believe it or not, the book that got me started actually on all this, I was on an African safari. I know you talk about reading. I was actually reading while we were going between villages. And it was when I was starting to take parenting very seriously. And there's a book called The Thriving Child.
When did you start to take parenting very seriously?
When my older one was 8 or 9. And where I could see that now I could influence, or I could be a positive or a negative influence, right? And fortunately, I think both are kind of finding their way well. So this talks about the thriving child is everything, you know, if you were to go ask a therapist, what is the pattern, the most common pattern they would see when they are in therapy with somebody, it's a person's childhood.
Absolutely, yes.
And when I have dug into my own past,
yes,
and I have analyzed certain behaviors in my present, I can pinpoint where it came from.
But personal life, behaviors in your personal life, yeah, or behaviors at work as well?
Both. Actually, generally, professional will be affected by the personal, not the other way around.
Yeah, you've always said that there's a link, right?
So for me, it's a harmony. Work and life are fully integrated. So almost everything I can, you know, one can pinpoint to that. So therefore, this thriving child actually was where I first realized that a child comes as their brain develops. That's why they're crying. They're happy. Slowly the planning comes in. The neocortex judgment. Why do children sometimes demonstrate poor judgment till they're adults? Because the neocortex hasn't formed. So all of this kind of came together, and I have therefore come to realize almost maybe two formulaic, show me a behavior and I can tell you
what happened in their childhood.
What is
that's
driving
dangerous
it?
Now. Yeah. I don't know what you're reading.
And of course, my wife says, you're the most judgmental person I know.
Are you judgmental? I mean, it's different. It's one thing to meet somebody and sort of analyze, oh, this is, and it's another thing to judge them on the basis of that.
So I used to be the latter, I've become the former. I used to be judgmental. Once you are able to figure out, judgmental comes from your own insecurity,
right?
So now I've become analytical. Now I can analyze and be dispassionate about it because I've also become secure. So I don't need to put somebody below or whatever to make myself comfortable. But I can very quickly say, my guess is that this has happened to them in the past and therefore this is
scary of me.
It helps in the business, by the way.
But when do you find the time to read? You said you were reading in this trip in Africa and you were reading, obviously with your family, I imagine. And then you're reading while you're traveling.
Yeah. You know, you wrote something here, I'll just read that out, which is reading makes one more receptive to new ideas, but only provide one reads with the aim of absorbing information. I would say I absorb information 5 to 6 hours a day. I may not necessarily be reading. So it's actually a little bit of the opposite, because reading is too much of a ritual. I do read.
So firstly, because this show is about your rituals, you're obviously such a busy person. Where do you find the time to read? Read at night? Do you have like an hour chalked out every day, but this is my time to read? How do you make time? Or do you listen to it? Do you listen to Audible?
All of the above. So in a day, should we go through the morning ritual also?
Yes.
So morning ritual is at least 45 to 60 minutes, starting with Daily Calm, which is a simple app. Then meditation, using one of the music, it's unguided meditation, probably for 15, 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
That and my style of meditation, and people may have done different, there are different philosophies. There's one where you block out your thoughts. There's one where you block, watch your thoughts. I live the thoughts and until they go away. And by that time, it's generally things that are churning, which I need to decide on. 95 to 99% of the time, the answer is clear by the end of that, right? It's generally done as a walking meditation. That's another concept from Vipassana. Mm-hmm. In that, you're only looking down. I'm generally looking out. So that's a ritual.
No. What do you mean?
So in Vipassana, for the first 9 days, you're not supposed to make eye contact with people.
Okay.
But you're supposed to walk and you're meditating. It's called a walking meditation. But you're not supposed to make eye contact.
What is the advantage of that?
Because you don't want emotion to get into... That's a Vipassana philosophy. Like I said, I have read everything, practiced everything, come up with my own method that works for me.
No, sure, yeah.
So what works for me is it is a walking meditation, but it is actually on a treadmill, looking straight out to the ocean and, you know, let whatever is churning and I'm listening to music. In the process, getting some exercise also. But the exercise is not taking over the meditation, because if you're huffing, puffing, all of that, then your mind will not reach peace.
So define meditation. So you're listening to music.
Yeah.
You're walking on this treadmill.
So you're breathing.
Yeah.
It's called a smiling meditation. You're breathing. Eyes are open. Eyes are not closed. You're breathing. You're watching your breath go up and down, up and down. It automatically starts putting, you know, you're actually trying to focus on that. Mm-hmm. And then your mind starts wandering.
And you allow your mind to wander.
Yes.
I thought the whole point is to not let your mind.
No, those are two different philosophies. Okay. There is a philosophy in Buddhism also, they are two different. It's transcendental, it's something. I don't forget the terms. The one that works for me is I follow the thoughts through.
Okay.
And then I'll bring it back. And generally, as those thoughts are churning, the answers are coming and then you come back to the breath. This is typically a 15 to 30 minute routine.
Okay.
Then there's a gratitude prayer. Mm-hmm. After which I switch to knowledge. So then I'll listen to a podcast. Could be self-improvement. It was crypto. Right now it's about markets. It could be anything. Right?
Sure.
It's very wide variety of topics.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the morning. Evening, then there is a routine around 5 to 6 p.m. where it's just reading. And that's...
Okay.
So if you look at I put the genres down. There is... Genre is current affairs, human psychology, investing, expertise going deep into some area. These are all the things I end up doing. Typically, I would say 3 to 4 hours a day of reading and weekends, 6 to 7 hours. Where does the time come from? I create time. I will sometimes not go to parties because next day, if I've partied and I've had a drink or two, you know, my morning routine goes off.
Absolutely.
So there's a trade-off.
Yes.
It's a trade-off. I enjoy this more and this fulfills me more.
So what does that mean? You have no social life?
No. I have a social life. I proudly call myself antisocial because I want to be branded that. So then there's no pressure.
Right.
You know, then nobody can tell me come to this party. I'll say, but I think my friends know better. I'm selectively social. What does that mean? It's not that I choose people that I will be social with. It is that I choose when I want to be social. Like last weekend, I think there were two events. I just said, no, this is my winding down weekend. I want to read and I must have last... You know, stuff like that.
So I want to get from there actually straight into something I wanted to talk about a little bit later, which is this this concept of radical candor.
Yeah.
But I'll let you describe it.
Yeah. Basically. No, so radical candor as a concept, you know, people can Google it. They'll see the framework. Where I read about it first was from Sheryl Sandberg.
Yeah.
Who is the CEO of Facebook, and she's 2 years senior to me from HBS. She's supposed to be this ultimate, and when you see her, I think it comes out, high EQ person, right? It's just oozing out. And the concept is really that most of the time in interpersonal relationships, I know we want to talk a little bit about that, or mostly this was in the context of professional relationships. Most people want to be liked. Bosses also want to be liked. In that desire to be liked, mm-hmm. often they don't tell people what they really think. And there's this concept of sandwich feedback. Great, 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 great. This is what you need to improve. Great, 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 great. And that this is what you need to improve is lost.
Squeeze it in there.
just squeeze it in there and then not feel bad, right? I think it's extremely unfair to the recipient because most of the time, the message has not gone across. You feel like you've done your job. You've just checked a box. Radical candor is just focusing on the issue, but with warmth and care. So it's radical, in its approach. So it generally starts, I still remember, she gave one example where somebody in the presentation was not doing a great job.
Right.
And she, after the presentation, put her arm around the person, so warmth, and I think it was a female. So she put her arm around the person, took them for a walk. And she didn't say, you did this wrong, you did this. The way it was said, which also, what the point is that you genuinely care about the person.
Mm-hmm.
Genuinely.
Yeah. So
and it has to be authentic. You're not faking it because it will come out. And she's the kind of person that I think she does genuinely care. When you do these things, this is how you come across, which is below your potential, right? And it's just a very different way of
framing the
it was true. It was true, right? And then, now you were going to ask whether it works in personal life.
In personal, because you just said that, okay, socially, you're choosing the situations, the events that you want to go to. You're not always going to be there.
Yeah.
Then you have this tough love approach, which is your radical candor, which is great. I know a lot of people, it's rare, but I think that this is something that... that a lot of people swear by, and it's very helpful. But I often will not win you friends.
We're
going to be very honest with people,
You
know, and especially in interpersonal relationships, right? I mean, for example, somebody's going through a divorce, which is what I was talking about. You have a friend crying over your shoulder.
Yeah.
They don't want to hear that, oh, the other person has a point of view.
Yeah.
They want to be told
right. So separate what is a personal issue versus a interpersonal situation. If somebody is going through a divorce, they don't need your gyan or your advice. You just need to be a shoulder they can cry on. And 90% of the time, all of us, and I also have realized this over a period of time, you feel like you have to help the person. You are helping the person by just listening.
Just by being there.
Just listening.
So either and be honest or don't offer advice.
No. So that is not a radical candor situation.
Yeah.
It is not for me at that time to say, you did this right,
yes.
you did this wrong. No.
So pick the
But
pick
however,
the
if a couple is having a problem, I think you have to have radical candor.
Yeah.
I have practiced it with my wife also.
Right.
So one has to separate that. Is this a situation that person is going through where you need to just, all you have to do is be there. That's it. Versus there is an interpersonal dynamic that by not doing this, you are actually potentially worsening by trying to push it under the carpet, right? So I think that's the distinction to make.
Right.
Actually, my friends probably value me the most because of the radical candor.
Oh, I'm sure.
Because even in a setting, 5% people will say, you are right, you are right. If people are seeking input, you're also part of some organizations where you have this concept of forums, right?
Right.
Where people are asking you for input. I don't go for groupthink. I'll tell them my view is something completely different, right?
Yeah.
The difference is also, there's a big difference between the what and the how. It's the delivery. If the delivery is warm and you really care, then it actually wins you more friends, right?
Okay.
Because you're being honest, but because you care.
Yeah.
And you're saying, and you don't have to be accusatory or put somebody down.
Absolutely.
Just saying, this is how I see it.
Yeah. So now, again, whether you're advising entrepreneurs or speaking to your friends or as part of, different forums, for a person to receive advice, they've got to have a level of humility, Now, I wanted to talk to you about that because, we have the old school of entrepreneurs in India. The traditional business houses that even still believe that you have got to sort of just keep your head down and focus on the work and don't make a lot of noise. And then you have the startups, which go the...
Are those first ones there still? Who?
I mean, you still have the... You do. You do
only
have
Mr.
the mystery.
Tata.
Yeah,
only
no.
Mr. Tata. And I have
Tata's
to tell you this
mystery.
Story. I was 10 years ago, I was flying. I was in the executive lounge, BA. Mr. Tata was there. He was carrying his... he always wears a suit and he has a suit... garment bag on his shoulder and a carry-on in one hand.
Yeah.
No entourage.
Right.
Would not let anybody touch.
Yes.
And then when I went and greeted him and I said, you obviously know, made me sit down, had a, tea.
Yeah.
Just that. But that is not there anymore. Please complete your question.
But
I don't think any of the industrial houses today.
No, I mean, I'm just saying that this whole startup space right now, there's so much noise and the noise actually works in their favor. You've also talked about how, marketing and all of that, because of this, you know, sort of chasing these valuations, you know, startups, often the mistake that they make is they're focusing on the valuations and you're not really focusing on the product, which is really where your attention should be. So what do you think? I mean, do you think that there's a space
for... Unless you are Elon Musk or Steve Jobs, you better be humble. Okay? They can get away with it.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you are... And look at what some of them do, and particularly Elon Musk. I know he may get made fun of, but I'm in awe of the guy. You know, to change space travel by saying, why do rockets burn? Let's make them land back.
Right.
It disrupts space travel, to disrupt EVs. If you're going to be such a disruptor, it cannot come if you're always valuing other people's opinions. It just cannot. But that's those two, three people.
Yeah.
I think everybody started imagining that they are them. Right? So to me, if you are geniuses are typically eccentric. If you are sure you are an eccentric genius, be my guest. Don't be humble. Yeah. Everybody else, you better be humble or you'll fail. ultimately, you have to learn. And if you're not humble, you will never learn. And then I don't think you'll succeed unless you're an eccentric genius.
Right. So you've also said that, I mean, a lot of people operate out of FOMO.
Yeah.
Right, in business and in personal life also in a collectivist cultures like ours.
Yeah.
People do operate out of this whole fear of missing out.
Yeah.
So how does one avoid that? Like you, I mean, when you say I don't attend this event or that event or whatever. How does one not get sucked into
what
that?
What does FOMO stand for?
Fear of missing out.
So what if you don't think you're missing out?
Yeah, but I mean, how do you switch?
That's where you have to get. That's where you have to get to. That you don't think you're missing out.
So the meditation helps with this?
So actually the bigger part is this concept of ikigai, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is when you are living your dream, when you're living the purpose of your life.
Yeah.
And that framework, I had actually, without knowing that it's a Japanese framework, after selling Bazi, before starting Matrix, I had to decide what do I want to do in life. And I couldn't figure it out. And being analytical, mathematically, so I drew a Venn diagram. I said, okay, passion, skill set, opportunity, and we have a podcast on this.
Right.
I need to work at the center of that. Ikigai adds meaning to that, right? And today in life, I have added meaning to that. When you are at the intersection of that, you don't care what anybody else is doing.
Yeah.
And I tell my wife sometimes in this context of socializing, in a good way, that life is full of joy, blessings. Family is great, knock on wood. Work is great. Meaning actually need to do more. You know, health is fine. So don't feel that I'm missing anything, right? Same thing happens at work. If you are clear in your investing frameworks. So,
right.
You know, I retweeted this very recently. Charlie Munger said this. I don't allow myself to have an opinion on something unless I know the other side's argument better than they do. That's, if you know that, you won't feel like missing out. Boss, pata hai aap kya soch rahe ho. Mere ko pata hai aap kya soch rahe ho, uski wajah se ye kar rahe ho, mere ko nahi karna. That's, then you're not feeling like missing out, right?
But so obviously we're all social animals,
right?
You've got your family and loved ones around you. They're all on the same page. Because I assume when you're not attending an event, either your wife has to go alone or she also is not attending that event.
No. So I wish they were all on the same page. My mom thinks, I should be, that I'm, how do I say it? That I've forgotten all my relatives and all that. Classic Indian stuff, right? So my wife and I have gotten a lot more on the same page, which means that she will go ahead if she wants to, which is more usually the case. Sometimes I'll go ahead and often we'll go together. Unfortunately, you end up having a lot of influence on each other. So you end up converging in your approaches also. So if I'm not going suddenly, her mood, she won't want to go either. That said, there is another psychological framework, which is a lot of bonding in life comes from shared moments.
Absolutely.
The more you do, so you have to balance it out, right? With your friends, if you're never going to show up, that bonding will also drift. So
obviously.
I have an analytical framework for everything. So once I feel that it's been a while, but it doesn't mean every weekend you can't be partying with the same people, right? So that's how I started.
No, so, you know, you mentioned,
by the way, nobody's on the same page. Like even this morning, Saturday night, you're coming to my place. I'm thinking of what excuse to make, but I think it's time I have to go.
So you know, you have this, you have your podcast, which you just briefly mentioned, Matrix Moments, which is an amazing podcast.
Thank you. Now, that's credit to Saloni.
Yeah, which is, I mean, the amazing thing is that you've always got this information out there that you're putting out there to help people live better lives, which is really the premise of the Uppercase podcast as well. And one of the things you talk about is this designated thinking time that you have, right? So again, how do you make time for everything? You've got meditation, you've got thinking time, you've got your work, you've got your family.
Yeah.
How do you make time for everything? Do you feel that you want to stretch the days out a little bit? And also, so what is designated thinking time? I mean, is it 15 minutes? Is it half an hour? Is it, what is that?
Yeah. So designated thinking time was more what we discussed earlier in
the
context
meditation?
Of the meditation and even at
but
night.
But so you have music going on, you're walking, how
no,
do you
No,
also?
It works. No, it's not music. It's not music. It is water falling on a tree.
There
is
no.
This is nature. It's very much nature. In fact, even any kind of meditative music doesn't work for me because it distracts me.
Right.
It has to be nature. It could be waves. It could be water falling on a tree or whatever. It has to be nature. Otherwise, I have introduced a different element.
I see.
It has to be nature. Nothing which is not in line with nature. Coming back to this, actually, I don't feel that it may sound weird, and I joke. So time is the ultimate wealth. And some of my multi-billionaire friends are always available for anything important. And I don't think it's an accident. I don't think they have the time because of which they have become, they have the time because they are billionaires. I think they have become billionaires because they're able to manage their time really well.
Yeah, it's tough.
And so I think all of us have this tendency to be busy, busyness, right? And I have actually made it a mantra at the firm, activity versus productivity. There's too much activity, not enough productivity. So I often say, just stop. You know, I'll actually push the brakes.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, it comes from clarity of priorities. If you are, and that's why I'm saying it's no accident that the people who are very successful in life seem to have the time.
Right.
Have the time, right. So I used to feel 2, 3, 4 years ago, I used to feel I'm on a treadmill, I'm running too hard, this. Then you step back and you say, what is important?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that changes. So again, I can't point to one answer in isolation of everything else.
Right.
All of these things are connected.
So
the meditation, taking the time, trying to just elaborating on that for a second. Let's say there is a very important issue that's bothering me. I will not be able to concentrate. If I'm not able to concentrate, a task that would normally, or you know, some email I have to write or whatever, may take me an hour, hour and a half. Versus that meditation in the morning, I will have such clarity that in 5 minutes I'm done. I've just created 55 minutes of freedom. So it all comes down to the higher brain.
Okay, I'm going to try this out.
Yeah,
I will let you know if it doesn't work.
But I'm telling you this, if one can, live most of our... Why does Dalai Lama look the way he does? Why was Mahatma Gandhi the way he was? They have figured out how to spend most of their life in their higher brain. We are... And that's a different level of consciousness. I'm saying with simple tools like meditation, sports, exercise, music.
Right.
One can use these tools to do that. And I'll give you one, may almost seem funny, biological approach to it also. You know, it's all about blood flow. The part of your brain that is, they have actually done this with MRI.
Mm-hmm.
The part of your brain that is active shows on the MRI as, so it almost tells you where you are thinking from.
Sure.
And if you're emotionally, then it'll be, you know, if you're emotionally active, it'll show up at the bottom. All these oxygen bars, it's all about pushing the blood flow. When people say, take a deep breath.
Yes.
It's all doing that.
Oh, absolutely. That really works. So, that really does give
so
you clarity.
So that changes the dynamic between time and decision making and judgment and emotion, it just frees up a lot of it.
So, you know, the fact that you've done all this introspection, that you keep thinking about it, where did it come from? How did this develop as a habit, you know, to read, to introspect, to meditate, all of this? Was it an incident that triggered it? Was it
no,
something
like I mentioned,
it
may be midlife crisis, but
no, because,
pursuit
you know,
of
you,
happiness.
You know, this when you did have, I mean, you
started
said that
with
you're...
parenting.
Started with
parenting. Started with, like I said, 2014, 15, starting to realize that this is something I really enjoy.
Hmm.
I generally want to be the best at whatever I do. So this also became a mission. I want to be the, you know, best parent. What does best parenting mean? It doesn't mean helicopter. It doesn't mean telling them what to do. You know, then you basically end up realizing that your job is just to create experiences for them and let them figure it out, right? With some boundary conditions. So it started there, and it started with a feeling of emptiness despite so-called success, right? Yeah. And then it got triggered more during COVID. COVID wave one, where the 2 months of the lockdown was actually awesome. Because I have a full journal I've written.
Yeah.
So this point, so all of this theory was there. Hmm. So between 5 years of attending Sadhguru's things, right. Sri, all theory had been accumulated, reading all Western philosophy. But the application ke liye time nahi tha.
Right.
And then lockdown mein, there was only time. So I started writing reflections and I went.
I see.
Age 0 to 5, which I remember very little, in 5 year increments of my life, what do I remember of that person and what was the personality? Why did that change? What was the trigger? And that's where I kind of figured it all out.
Wow.
That's where the judgment went away, because then suddenly the story became clear.
But you know, you also, Avnish, you know, you did have, people look at you and they, you know, you see a successful person and you don't imagine that they've had any sort of hardships along the way. But you also had an incident where, you know, the content, somebody had posted content which was obscene.
Yeah.
And then you were, because it was your company, you were then therefore taken to jail.
Yeah.
And you spent a couple of days in jail. For you, you look back at it and it's not something that you think of, oh, you know, you had to do this.
Yeah.
So there's that positivity that even was there that early. Can you tell me about that experience?
No, so yeah. So I actually come to the experience, you know, but in this, when I dug deep into the in my own history, that episode doesn't, so the episode that features way above all this was, I was we are a Sikh family. We were living in a small town in Bihar during the Sikh riots.
Wow.
And we have had mobs running through our house. My father being taken away when I was 13 or 14, basically not knowing if I'll see him again. It was just, so actually that was the real trauma. When I dug deep, I realized that was the first real trauma, right? That affected a lot of my, you know, it manifested itself in different ways. And when you hit there, when you hit it, then it's gone, right? This one, so to your
You're saying
point,
recognizing it helps you deal with it.
But I'm saying, if you have been through that, where you are hiding in an attic, and there is a mob running around, shouting out, looking for you, to kill you, Tihar jail seems safe. But if I hadn't analyzed all this, even I was surprised how come it seemed so normal to me. So the physical part of it didn't scare me at all. Emotionally, it was very traumatic.
I'm sure it must have been.
So I was arrested. The law at that time, and by the way, now there's a debate around India has passed a law about media, right? Who's responsible?
Right.
In those days, it's not like the marketplace was responsible. But the burden of proof that was on the marketplace to prove they did everything right.
Right.
As opposed to the law that got changed thanks to my arrest, that the burden of proof is on the government to prove that we didn't do something correct.
Right. Right.
Which is a huge difference.
Of course.
So you know, then we had to prove versus the government has to prove. So the arrest was traumatic, but because of having dealt with adversity before in life, and I think that's where the resilience and some of that comes from, right? And then when I... and my father was a very senior person in the government, but we lived in small town India.
Right.
And happiness and misery often is relative. When you see people around you that are not very well off, and you know, when you're growing up in this world, I felt blessed all my life, right? And therefore, there was no entitlement. If you have no entitlement, you have gratitude, which I think I often struggle with, frankly, now with the newer generation. But if you have just daily gratitude, It's a different way to live. That feeling, I wouldn't say gratitude was there at that time, but the entitlement has never been there.
Right.
It has always been that, and there has been this fundamental view that things will figure it out. You have to do best work. The Bhagavad Gita kind of thing. You have to do your karma and the things will. That piece was always there. So that helped.
Mm-hmm.
what I mentioned to you offline, the fact that very publicly, and I think Snigdha and all were probably much are aware of all of that at that time, very publicly there was an outpouring of support. So when you're inside and you're opening, no, you don't have to open the newspaper because you are on the newspaper, you're the first front page. But it's all positive and it's all about everybody kind of saying why this is wrong, that helps. You know, right. If it was negative, it would have been worse.
So. Yeah, I'm sure. But again, see, that's also the your attitude to it.
Yeah, because it was more instinctive at that time.
Okay, so you know, we were just talking a little bit earlier about managing time. Yeah, now I wanted to ask you about this need to scale, which also is something that you've talked about. Companies do need to scale, yeah. Right? So, but are you a fan of the slow and steady approach then when it comes to startups, or do you think that they need to find a way to scale up quickly?
So, you know, obviously, right now, market has turned. Last 2 years was a bubble. I would actually argue from 2017 has been a bit of a bubble. This boom and bust cycles of startups is a feature, not a bug. It's a good thing. If startups were going to be linear like this, everybody would do it. It has to be gut-wrenching. It has to be up and down. So I would argue the behavior last year of scale at any cost was very rational because money was free.
Right.
When money is free, take as much as you can, right?
Sure.
Now money is becoming expensive.
Yes.
Now save as much as you can, right? So when you ask me what is the right answer, I'll say it depends. It depends on the context.
Circumstances.
It depends on the context. Right now, we started off by saying this is the best time to start businesses. I continue to believe that, but money has become expensive. So how you run that business, you have to focus more on unit economics, profitability. A year from now, if money becomes free again, go get as many customers as you can.
Right.
So this is sometimes not understood well enough that this is actually what may come across as irrational behavior is extremely rational and capitalistic. Right. So to me, the narrative has changed. Context has changed. It may take a while. Okay. It may be like this for a while, in which case, yes, one needs to be. So I'm not a fan of one approach or
the other.
It depends on the context. So in this context, you have to build it differently. You may not be able to raise around at crazy prices for another year or two or whatever. Now, all that said, I am a believer that you must build great businesses that are customer focused. I think what happens sometimes in this is the customer gets lost. You know, the reason Elon Musk is going out for Twitter is because he believes that they have lost. By the way, I don't know if you have seen this. I had almost stopped using Twitter. And then he put this post out that go to the top right and sort it with the most recent tweet first. I just did it in the last 2 days. I started using it again because I didn't know they were throwing stuff at me that was just stuff they wanted to throw. Right? It was all ad-driven.
Right.
So keep your customer in mind, irrespective of the environment. Even if you're getting them for free, keep them in mind. I think that's where overall, I think the narrative gets lost sometimes and more so in India. Somehow we have never been this. We say Atithi Deva Bhava, but the customer Deva Bhava should be there.
Right.
And the second is more keep the customer in mind, keep economics in mind. But dial up or dial down depending on the cost of money.
Sure. Now, okay, so last question for you is since you mentor entrepreneurs, what would you say are some qualities that they must have in order to succeed?
Resilience, grit. So we have a podcast on this where we talk about intrinsics versus extrinsics. And intrinsics, going back to now, you know, through the thread of this, we have talked about childhood. Most people are a product. In my view, when I meet an entrepreneur, I probably spend more time on their first 18 years of life than of their previous 7 years. Because I think they are more a product of that. That's the intrinsics. And there's actually another book which is titled, this was one of those when I went into the quest of parenthood, which says how children succeed. And essentially it comes down to, it analyzes everything and it says, it comes down to the character you help them build. And the character is defined in certain ways, which is intrinsics. Hunger to succeed, grit, fearlessness, so on and so forth. I would say for entrepreneurs, top two, fearlessness and grit. For investors, top curiosity, number one curiosity. Now, there's hustle, there's a bunch of other things, but I would say those are the traits. Extrinsics is the life experiences they have had, right? In the new world where we have actually now started backing founders, we call them experienced founders because they are people who have been in the industry for a while. Actually, you would in that context, you've been in media, you're doing media, so you are an experienced founder profile. Typically, they bring the best of both. They're able to marry because they've had that fearlessness, you know, great thing, and then they have experience in the domain.
Right.
The biggest reason startups fail is because something unknown happens to them. If the founder knew it would happen, he won't let that, or he or she won't let that happen. If you're from the domain, the number of unknowns is lower.
Sure.
You just have more knowledge, right?
So sure. That's I just want to understand, when you say fearlessness, isn't there a danger when you're fearless of being reckless?
Sorry. Well, fearlessness and recklessness are two different things. they are fearless people who are not reckless. I'm not one of them. Well, maybe. It depends on which part of my brain is thinking. And another part is that fearlessness, you know the definition. The definition is or brave, being brave or whatever. It is not the absence of fear. It is facing your fear, right? And that's the difference. Reckless people will go, you know, essentially put themselves in situations which may generate negative probability events for them. So, no, I think fearlessness is very important. Because it will get tested a lot.
Sure. Thank you so much. This was a great note to end on. Thank you so much, Avnish. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. My pleasure.
This is amazing.
And all the best for your podcast series.
Thank you so much.